So the theme of this retreat, the last time I looked at the program, was is it spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spiritual receptivity? I think that's it, yeah. And we're putting particular emphasis, Satyaraj is giving particular emphasis to spiritual receptivity with the emphasis on the just sitting practice, non-practice. And these terms, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spiritual receptivity, come from Sangharakshita's system of spiritual discipline, system of spiritual practice. And there are a number of expositions of that around at the moment. But when he originally talked about it, he talks about the first stage of the path being integration that's brought about through the practice of mindfulness. Then there's the stage of positive emotion that's brought about particularly through the metta bhavana and related practices. Spiritual death is brought about particularly through insight meditation practices, particularly the meditation on the elements. Spiritual rebirth is brought about particularly through the visualization meditation of a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And as Satyaraja has said, so well this morning, that just sitting is a sort of non-practice that interleaves, as it were, all of these other practices, so that you have the aspect of being receptive. There are other versions of this system of practice, which I will go into. But one of the things that's very important to bear in mind with any path, a path has a goal. That goal in Buddhist tradition is, of course, enlightenment itself, and it's the same with our own movement. The goal is Bodhi, enlightenment. The goal is wisdom and compassion embodied in the figure of the Buddha. This is the meaning, by the way, of the refuges. Buddham saranam gacchami, to the Buddha for refuge I go, is a commitment to attaining enlightenment as the Buddha attained enlightenment. It might be a very far, a very lofty, sublime, profound goal, but that is indeed our orientation. That's where the path gets its meaning, from its, as it were, endless end. And Sangharakshita, in another exposition of the earliest exposition of his own way of understanding the path to enlightenment, speaks about the end of the path in a very interesting way. He talks about the end of the path, the goal, enlightenment, as spontaneity. Spontaneity. Everybody gets really excited. Spontaneity. I like the sound of that. Bit of spontaneity. But then he qualified that and said, or no more learning. That's the other name, which is even more exciting, isn't it? The path of no more learning. Nothing more to learn. I mean, a lot of the time we feel that we're already at that stage anyway, but it's not the no more learning of the Buddha. We're at the no more learning of arrogance, very often, conceit. But the Buddha's enlightenment is a stage of no more learning, or spontaneity, nishta, nija, sahaja, naturalness, spontaneity. But it's also called spontaneous compassionate activity. Spontaneous compassionate activity. That's the state of enlightenment. And then he starts to explain what that kind of looks like. And he uses this phrase, which is you're slightly disappointed when he says it. You do what needs to be done. You do what needs to be done. And when I first read that, I thought, hang on, I was expecting sort of lights and flashing and all the rest of it, spontaneous compassionate activity, maybe something tantric. You do what needs to be done. And actually, that, when you think about it, that's extraordinarily profound. Doing what needs to be done. There's nothing between you and what needs to be done. You have the quality of wisdom and knowing that sees exactly, precisely what needs to be done to alleviate the suffering around you, to bring about the liberation and the growth of others around you. So there's no ignorance. There's clear, precise seeing. And there's no limit to your loving. There's nothing in the way of your loving. If you like, accurate, precise loving. That's what it means to do what needs to be done. And this is, of course, how the Buddha lived. After his enlightenment, he didn't just stay in the forest. He wandered. He communicated, communicated spontaneously to people. Sometimes it would be a sort of formal, gradual discourse. Sometimes it's a chance meeting. You know, you can read the Pali Canon for this in particular, but you get the impression of the Buddha as being this incredible stream of selfless, spontaneous activity. And of course, he's a wanderer. He wears the patched rag robes. He possesses nothing other than his robes and his bowl. He's got no family. He's got no dependents. He's got no responsibilities in that sense. So he's completely free to serve. That's the meaning of renunciation in Buddhist tradition. That's the meaning of celibacy in Buddhist tradition. You are completely free to serve the people and to bring about liberation. So there's this spontaneous activity to bring about the transformation of others, turn them into Buddhas, establish them on the path. And what's fascinating about the Buddha's life is that not only did he do that, provide a path, he also created or started a social revolution. A complete sort of transformation of Indian society. So much so that in the 1950s there was this great conversion movement led by Dr. B.R. Ambedkar to Buddhism from the so-called ex-untouchable Dalit communities, because they saw the Buddha and the path of spiritual transformation, dharmic transformation, as a way of bringing about social revolution. Because what the Buddha responds to is the human. Is the human. He responds to the human in its deepest and fullest sense. That's what the path that the Buddha teaches gives to us. It gives us a path of human transformation, human life lived to its ultimate end, Buddhahood, spontaneous, compassionate activity. That's our aim. That's the end of the path. Say the endless end, because in a sense there is, you know, the Buddha never stops, it just goes on spontaneously unfolding without any kind of naturally unfolding, if you like, deeper and deeper into the ocean of the Dharma, into the ocean of the truth. And the Buddha, it seems, just lived like this right until his parinirvana, his final passing, this mysterious state when the body just drops away and he enters, if you like, undiluted nirvana, a state which nobody knows anything about, this deep, deep mystery of parinirvana. And he was teaching on his, well, you can't really call it a deathbed, because parinirvana isn't death, it's the transcendence of birth and death. Anyway, the stone couch on which he was lying, he was still teaching. There were still people coming for teaching. He was still teaching his disciples. He was still responding with compassion, you know, especially to his close friend and attendant, Ananda. But at last, we have the Buddha's final words before he enters parinirvana. Look, all constructed, put together things are impermanent. With mindfulness, strive. With mindfulness, strive. Behold, look, everything is impermanent. With mindfulness, strive. With mindfulness, make effort. The Buddha's last words. And they're also the words that they crop up after you give the refuges and precepts in our ordination ceremony. We have the Pali words, which the preceptor chants. Appamadena sampadeta. With mindfulness, strive on. And Sangharakshita always used to say that if you just have these two things, mindfulness and striving, you won't go wrong in your spiritual life and your Dharma life. If you keep up your mindfulness and your striving, you will succeed. So it's interesting that the Buddha's last words involve this word mindfulness, and it's also the beginning of the path, mindfulness. And it's mindfulness I'm going to talk about tonight. The actual word for mindfulness, translated as mindfulness here, is appamada, apramada in Sanskrit. Pramada means intoxication. Appramada means non-intoxication. But in Pali and Sanskrit, when you have a sort of negative like this, the appamada, appramada, it's a positive. So it means something more like wakefulness, vigilance. And this is very, very important. It's this quality of being really awake and alive and vigilant. You've woken up to the fact that, well, yes, life is impermanent. You know, presumably that's why you're here. Something has got you thinking about the Dharma. Something about life isn't adding up for you, and you've decided that you want to wake up. You've decided that you want to switch the lights on and really do something. So this is why mindfulness is the beginning of the path. I think there's a lot of material around about mindfulness these days. It's becoming a very popular way of helping people with various difficulties. But it's very, very important to realise that the Buddhist and the Buddha's vision of mindfulness is extraordinarily rich and broad and deep and wide-ranging. And we should take very great care when people say that they're an expert in mindfulness. They might not have the training or the knowledge which comes from the best, the broadest, the deepest Buddhist tradition. There are a number of terms for mindfulness, different aspects of this quality of wakefulness. So apramada is a very, very important one. This sort of vigilance, you've kind of woken up and you need to keep waking up. And it has a quality, this vigilance, the way it's sort of described in the Buddhist tradition, it has a kind of warrior-like quality to it. Remember, I have to remember that the Buddha came from a warrior community. He was a Kshatriya. Shakya, as in Shakyamuni, means fierce, by the way. Shakyamuni means the fiercely silent one, if you were to translate it literally. But it's not fierce in the sense of anger or aggression or anything like this. It's the fierceness of awareness, the bright light, the bright quality of awareness. And the Buddha has this to say in the Dhammapada, in the section on mindfulness. And this is the second chapter of the Dhammapada. It's that important. Love this verse. Mindfulness is the way to the deathless. Unmindfulness, the way to death. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. Fantastic. Really fantastic verse. And in a way, it begs the question, doesn't it? Well, are we actually in the deathless? Are we actually in that state of, in a sense, the eternal? Not in the sense of sort of living indefinitely, but this living quality, this wakeful quality. Or are we spacing out, unmindful, already dead, actually walking corpses? That's the question. The Dhammapada is a bit like that, these verses. So it's a real wake-up call. And it does give us a sort of sense of a different kind of quality about what mindfulness is really like. It's this wakeful quality. You certainly get this impression of when you read stories from the Pali Canon about the Buddha and the great disciples. They have this wakeful quality to them. And the Buddha's likened to a lion, to an elephant, to a tiger. Animals which are really alive. You know, they're really powerful. That's the kind of quality of the Buddha's mindfulness. So at the beginning of the path, if we're talking about the development of mindfulness, we need to develop this wakeful quality. It's very, very strong wakeful quality. There's a kind of alertness to mindfulness. That's another translation of this word, apramada. I'm talking like this partly to counter, I think, views about mindfulness, which I think lead to a sort of preciousness in people, a preciousness that you've got to take really great care, especially of yourself, and you're very, you know, overly focused on yourself and your mental states, and so on and so forth. That is a travesty of mindfulness. That is a travesty of the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness with this vigilance. It's the sort of thing you see sometimes. I haven't seen it on this retreat yet, but I have seen it on retreat sometimes in the washing up, particularly in the evenings when you've got another thing going on. You get this thing where you see some people who think they know a bit about mindfulness, and they're very mindfully kind of wiping the china and kind of looking around and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, you know, the clock's ticking. You know, there are people trying to work very hard to get things done, to move on to the next things. That is grossly unmindful. You might be having a wonderful experience in the moment of rubbing a plate, but you are, I'm afraid, completely out of it when it comes to vigilance. You're not, you know, mindfulness is about the whole field of activity that you're engaged with. It's an awareness that extends in time. It anticipates the next event. It's not frenetic, it's not speedy or anything like that. It's purposeful, it's clear, it's aware of other people, it's aware of the consequences of actions. So, you know, bear that in mind when you hear about the practice of mindfulness. It's this quality of vigilance and wakefulness, and the opposite of being dead. I mean, the other example I think of is of gross unmindfulness is people just spacing out, kind of wandering around. You know, that sort of thing where you suddenly turn up in a room and you kind of ask, well, how have I got here? You know, what happened? You know, why am I here? You know, what happened? You're going to wander around. Might even sort of stumble into the shrine room. You know, suddenly, I suppose we ought to be meditating. Well, you know, vigilance, apramada, wakefulness. You know, we're here because of the Buddha. We're here because of the very embodiment of mindfulness. We need to really sort of, you know, tune up and wake up to what's actually going on in our life. So that's the first quality of mindfulness that I want to mention. It's not forceful, this. It's not in any way aggressive or anything like that. A book that I was very inspired by some years ago is a book called Forest Recollections, and another one called The Buddha in the Jungle, which is about the original Thai forest tradition, when there really were forests and jungles in Thailand. Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Tate, Ajahn Chah, actually, when he was a younger man, and some of these disciples. Quite obvious, this is an incredible tradition. And these boys, they really practice vigilance and mindfulness in the jungle, in a jungle infested with tigers, poisonous snakes, and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, amazing stories of walking along a track, and suddenly there's this massive tiger in front of you, and poof, up comes the mindfulness. You know, it's not sort of spacing out. It's not suddenly kind of, you know, it's this vigilant wakefulness, mindfulness in the face of death, of certain and sudden death. Sometimes they didn't make it. There were bones and scraps of robe found, but sometimes they said no, their mindfulness practice, their metta practice was such that the tiger would go away. So this is the kind of mindfulness we're talking about. And of course the Buddha lived in the jungle, his disciples lived in the jungle. That gives a completely different take on mindfulness compared with us moderns in our, you know, in our houses and our centrally heated places and all the rest of it. These people lived mindfulness out in the open. They lived this life of vigilance. And being aware meant being intensely practical, intensely tuned up to the environment. So that's a bit about vigilance. Vigilance is also said to have a quality that protects the skillfulness that you've generated, is alert to the development of further skillfulness, and protects you against the arising of what's unskillful. So there is this kind of warrior, anticipatory quality. Let's say you go into a room or something like that, and you get into a conversation with somebody, and you can see that the conversation, if it carries on in a certain way, you could start getting very, very reactive, even sort of breaking the speech precepts. Well, if you have apramada, you'll very, very skillfully avoid that situation. You'll either walk away, or you'll very carefully and skillfully redirect the conversation. So there's this quality of anticipation with apramada. Very, very good quality of mindfulness that you need, especially, I think, when you're in the city. But anyway, so the more well-known word for mindfulness, however, is smriti in Sanskrit, sati in Pali. And this is a really interesting word with actually many meanings. We translate it as mindfulness, which is actually a very good translation. I'll say more about that in a moment. But it literally means memory. Sati, smriti, memory. Or recollection. And here we find what mindfulness does. It's a collecting of oneself, a recollecting of oneself. It's as if we're scattered over many, many things. We have scattered attention. And what we're doing in mindfulness is gathering it all together. Gathering ourselves together into a rich, broad, deep, concentrated stream and flow and direction. That's what we're doing. That's why it's so necessary as the first stage of the path, because it brings about this integration. In the path that Sangharakshita has described is based on a very ancient description of the path. And the first stage of the path is called Sambara Marga, which means the path of gathering. That's what mindfulness does. It gathers. It gathers everything that's sort of disparate within us so that there's something coherent. It's very, very difficult to make any real progress if we're split, if we're scattered. Very, very difficult to really get behind any kind of Dharma life, any kind of meaningful human life, if you're split and scattered and all over the place. So mindfulness does this, brings about this gathering. It's sort of like the gathering of provisions. You know, if we were going to go on a sea journey, if we were going to get in the ship and, row across sail across the great Dharma ocean, we're going to have to gather lots of provisions. We're going to have to gather things together in order to do that. So we need to gather ourselves at the beginning of the path. Otherwise, our continuity will just be broken. You know, the famous one that's often mentioned, you decide the night before that you're going to get up and meditate first thing in the morning. And overnight, another self has taken over, which in the morning decides to stay in bed. I mean, that's not going to happen to any of you on this retreat, is it? Because you've all got to get up and come and meditate in the shrine, so that's okay. But we need to, if we're like that, if we've got these different selves just whimsically deciding, what we're going to do at any given moment, we're not going to make any real progress at all. We need to be a coherent, patterned, integrated individual if we're going to make any real progress. And this is one of the great ways in which the mindfulness of breathing works. It's such a beautiful practice because one of the things it does, it simplifies experience. There's a simplification in that practice. We were talking in our group yesterday about one of the traditional words actually for meditation, one of the stages for meditation, and that is viveka, which means something like withdrawal or seclusion, or even solitude. They talk about kaya viveka, where you take your body away from all the different things that distract you. In other words, you go on retreat, like this one. You take yourself away from the usual distractions and mobile phones and all the rest of it and all the usual things that you've going on. So there's a simplification right there. You're secluded, as it were, in Padmaloka. You've cut down, if you like, the range of reference to something much simpler. You've got a program, you know, a daily program, which is just the same. You don't have to think about what you're going to do. You just have to follow the bells. So there's a wonderful sort of simplicity. You've decided on that. You know, I know you kick against it, but that's just Mara. That's just, you know, the distracting forces. But you've simplified down. That helps with this process of integration, the rhythmic, regular life. And then you have what's known as citta viveka, and that is taking the mind away from, withdrawing the mind away from distractions, all the chatter, all the stuff that goes on in the mind, through simplifying your experience in meditation with the breath, with all the different sensations in the body. Maybe it'll be the sounds in the room, whatever it might be. And in this way, you integrate quite naturally, quite easily. And you know, you will notice it as time goes on. Everything will start to sort of still, and you'll start feeling your experience flowing together. It's quite subtle. Maybe you won't notice it until the end of the retreat. This sort of coming together of things. But this is what mindfulness does. This is one of the ways in which the mindfulness of breathing works. You know, a greater and greater simplicity. Obviously, it's harder to maintain, you know, in the world around us, in our ordinary life. But we need to maintain it. We need to maintain that integration, that simplification. So daily meditation is so important, you know, for that. But it's not enough just having a sitting meditation practice. We need more than that to bring about this integration, this continuity of purpose. We need to practice mindfulness in all the areas of life, in different areas of life. It is probably the most sort of famous Buddhist practice, continual mindfulness, alertness, attention. It's such a key practice. It's not the only Buddhist practice. Some people would say that it is the only Buddhist practice, but you know, that is, you know, patently nonsense when you look at the Buddha's teaching. But it is a really central practice, and it's very, very difficult to make progress without the development of mindfulness. And we need to start on an extremely basic level when we talk about mindfulness. I remember years ago, a quite senior order member, quite well known for his meditation teaching, nobody present, by the way, asked Bhante about going deeper in meditation, and particularly insight, and you know, what was the thing that was really needed. And Bhante was really interesting. I don't know whether it was said for this particular order member or it was a general point. He said, I think mindfulness is really lacking. And he said, when I say mindfulness, I mean mindfulness about extremely basic things, like turning the lights off when you leave a room, not slamming doors, not dropping things and breaking things, turning up on time, not leaving things behind, putting things back where you took them from, and so on and so forth. And a few of us were getting quite embarrassed as it went on. He said, you know, if you can't do those things, how can you possibly hope to develop transcendental insight? You know, it's that basic. It's that human, actually, to begin with. It's that human, the practice of mindfulness. You know, it's mindful eating, mindful sleeping, mindful walking, etc., etc. And it's very, very a very, very simple kind of human thing that we need to engage with first of all. I'm talking to myself, by the way. I'm not you know, when in saying this, I'm not setting myself up as an expert in these areas by any means. But that's the sort of area where we start. But I want to look at this word mindful a little bit, because it's a translation of this word sati or smriti, but it's very much a rendering of that term, because that does literally mean recollection. But Sangharakshita is quite interesting when he expounds mindfulness, because he says the etymology means that what you're doing is full of mind. Full of mind. That's what being mindful means. I really like this. It's like mind. And he doesn't mean thought. He means mind, awareness, alertness, consciousness, life, if you like, is pervading and permeating and perfuming all your experience. I think this is very important, because sometimes people can get the idea that mindfulness is a sort of little man in your head or on top of your head, sort of looking down at you, looking down, oh, I am now moving my arm. I am now moving my foot. You know, a kind of controller in the head. Well, this leads to alienated awareness, what Sangharakshita has called alienated awareness. You have an awareness, but you're actually alienated from your experience. You're not in touch with your experience. And that can lead to some very, very strange states. And it's something to watch out for. He's saying, no, mindfulness. Mind is perfectly fused with experience. You're experiencing, and you're aware that you're experiencing. You're living it, if you like. You're living through it in full awareness. So there's this, perhaps another word that sometimes people use, which I think does have some virtue, is presence. You know, you're fully present in your experience. Your experience isn't over there. You are in it. There's this quality of experiencing, and the awareness is, yes, pervading it, perfuming it, colouring it, if you like, for the good. So I really like that way of talking about mindfulness by Sangharakshita. It's not something apart from, you know, what you're doing. It's integrated awareness, as he's called it in one of his lectures. But to get a real feel, perhaps, for how it works, we need to look at the sort of, as it were, the objects or the fields of mindfulness. In classic Buddhist tradition, these are the satipatthanas, the foundations or the establishments of mindfulness. But I'm not going to talk about those, important though they are. I'm going to talk about another teaching of Sangharakshita's that I really love from when I first encountered it, called the four dimensions of awareness. They're something that he's sort of come up with himself, but they're certainly not non-traditional. They have a very strong traditional resonance. But I really love this set, because I think they bring out aspects of mindfulness and awareness which are of very great importance, especially for us moderns, actually. And I think one of the things they do is that this particular teaching undermines a subjectivity that can really bedevil the Dharma life for people in the West, an over preoccupation with self and mental states. I think they really counter that. So the first dimension of awareness is awareness of things, awareness of the environment, awareness of nature. Satyaraja's been suggesting that we go up to the nature reserve, that we walk along the track. It's a wonderful field of awareness, you know, with the wind in your face, and went for a walk today with the rain in my face, and, you know, and the mud and the rotting leaves and the bark and the trees and the reeds and, you know, the sort of succulent smells and so on. Well, this is all mindfulness practice. awareness of your environment, really, really being in it. It's so important not to, you know, mindfulness, one of the things it does, it overcomes that distinction between self and world, self and other. That's one of the things that mindfulness is doing. It's your mind, as it were, is out there, pervading your environment. You might even start to experience it as a kind of have all having a living quality, a living kind of wakeful quality all around you. But it's not just, you know, the beauties of nature and things like that. It's ordinary things like tables and chairs and, yes, the washing up and your bed and, you know, the bathroom and, you know, really, really ordinary things. Everything is a field of practice. This is the most wonderful thing about mindfulness, is that, you know, it means practice is everywhere and all the time. I remember in a seminar, somebody was saying, "Oh, Bhante, it's really difficult practicing mindfulness in the city." He said, "No, it's not. It's very easy. I mean, you just contemplate a brick wall. Just contemplate a brick wall. Brick walls are fascinating. Just look at a brick wall." And I think that, you know, he lived in London at the time, and, you know, I think there was a brick wall outside his window, and you got the impression that he spent a lot of his time looking at this brick wall. You know, saying, no, don't sort of let yourself off the hook. You know, it's all this out there is a field of mindfulness, is a field of awareness. And Satyaraja was saying, I think it was yesterday or before the retreat, you were talking about, was it to do with this awareness of that we're not in a dead universe? Yeah. That Sangharakshita has said that you need to experience the universe as living, as alive, even saying that that's indispensable for enlightenment. You know, because if you don't experience the universe as alive, if you treat it as dead, you won't be able to practice ethics. You won't be able to really revere and respect and really care for your environment. You'll just sort of trample over it. I assume that's what he means. So in this mindfulness of the world around us, we develop a much greater sensitivity, you know, to the world around us. There's a very strong aesthetic, you know, quality to it as well. But as I say, that shouldn't lead to a preciousness either, that, oh, I've got to just be in, you know, really refined environments in order to practice mindfulness. If I'm in an ugly, nasty, messy environment, I can't really practice it. Just a little experience I had many years ago. I lived in India for quite a long time, and in the 1980s I lived in Bombay, and Bombay is a pretty rough city, I have to say. And I was very inspired, though, while I was living in Bombay because of the Buddhist community there. And we were doing lots of Dharma work. And, you know, it can, you know, the tenement blocks, the slums, the pollution, you know, can really get to you. But I was quite inspired. And at that time, I was reading a lot of early translations of Rumi and other Sufi poets, the more literal translations, which are extraordinarily rich. And one day I noticed some things, and out came this poem. And, you know, it's about, I think, mindfulness, awareness, even in the city, even in a very, very rough city, very dirty, ugly city like Bombay. I called it Rumi in Bombay. "We have seen you, beloved, in the amber sun, climbing through the smog haze of morning. Seen you in a scarlet hibiscus trembling by the railway. Seen you in swallows dancing in the pink air of evening above crumbling ochre tenements. And we have seen you at night by an open sewer in the wide jet eyes of the slum child, grubby hands folded in prayer. We have seen you, beloved. You make even this wilderness touch paradise." So mindfulness of things, mindfulness of environment, can even start to transform your perception of your surroundings. You don't, You stop seeing them in that same tired old way. And of course, that's having a very powerful effect on you. It's refining your sensibility. It's also making you less caught up with yourself and much more concerned about the world around you. Nonetheless, mindfulness does refer to oneself. So the second dimension of awareness that Sangharakshita talks about is awareness of self. Awareness of self. And this has three aspects, which he makes very simple. First of all, awareness of the body and its movements. Not just the body, but the body and its movements. Awareness of feelings and emotions. And awareness of thoughts. So these are the sort of fields that we can focus on. So the awareness of the body and its movements. Buddhist tradition is very, very strong about awareness of the body and its movements. I remember years ago seeing that, many, many years ago, that series called The Long Search. Is it Ronald Searle did on the television? Not Ronald Searle, no. Can't be him. He's the cartoonist. Anyway, he said there was a shot of a Theravadin monk doing walking meditation very, very gracefully, very, very mindfully, beautifully. And the narrator, who also produced the series, said this was the most eloquent sermon he'd ever heard. And there were no words. The most eloquent sermon about peace, about mindfulness, about self-possession, about living a religious life. And we know that the Buddha was incredibly mindful from the records. It said that the Buddha had an elephant walk. An elephant walk, because when an elephant walks, each foot goes down very deliberately, very firmly. But of course, the Buddha also worked very lightly. Don't try and imitate the elephant walk in a crude sense, especially in the shrine room. You'll upset people. But also the Buddha's footsteps are very light. So, but it's this sense of purpose and the eyes cast down, looking ahead, but always aware out of the corner of the eye and actually knowing where he was going, what he was doing. The Buddha is also said to have had an elephant look. You know, he would never just look over his shoulder or something like that. He'd turn and really face the person who was addressing him, give them their full attention. So there's this, and again, as with the awareness of the environment, because mindfulness of the body and its movements can be practiced all the time, it means practice can go on all the time. When we're eating, when we're going to the toilet, when we're washing, when we're walking, cleaning our teeth, whatever we're doing, we can practice this mindfulness of the body and the movement. We know how our body is placed, we know how our body is doing. But bear in mind as well that quality of mindfulness, it's pervading the entire body. It's not you watching yourself, you are in your body. An elephant hasn't got a little man on its head kind of telling it to be mindful. Those legs are alive. So in the same way, when we practice mindfulness of the body and its movements, the mindfulness is fully fused with the activity. I do think, I'm not anybody to speak here, but I do think physical disciplines are really important for mindfulness of the body. Yoga, Tai Chi, the martial arts, different kinds of workouts and so on and so forth, and taking care of our body. Another very important aspect of mindfulness of the body is that it's regarded in tradition as very, very precious. The human body is regarded as the most precious thing that you could possess, because it's with this body that we can gain enlightenment, with this body that we can gain liberation. So part of mindfulness of the body is caring for the body, sensibly caring for the body, so that it will really support our Dharma life. So that's the mindfulness of the body and its movements. As Satyaraja said as well, that in the tradition they also talk about the way you move. You should move like a cat or a thief. you're that silent in the way you in the way you operate. You know, you don't make waves, you know, all around you. You know, and I think this is especially true of the shrine room, because we've got quite a creaky floor. So it's really important to move very silently, to come in very silently, to leave very silently. One could even say that you're, you know, perhaps to overstate it, when you meditate, you're preparing to leave the shrine room well. You're preparing to leave the shrine room well. That's the aim of the meditation, to leave as mindfully, as silently, and as considerately as you possibly can. So that's a little bit on the mindfulness of the body and its movements. Then mindfulness of feelings and emotions. He doesn't really say a lot about this. He just talks about, you know, keeping it really simple. You know what you're feeling. Is it pleasurable? Is it painful? Is it neither pleasurable or painful? You know, whether it's in the body or it's in the mind, wherever it is. You know, what is it? What's that feeling? And with more complex, you know, feelings that are worked up into emotions, is this love? Is this hate? Is this jealousy? Is this fear? Is this, you know, lack of confidence? Is this confidence? Etc., etc. So he's talking really there, I think, about a sort of self-honesty. You know, there's another way perhaps one could talk about being mindfulness, and that is being truthful. Being actually true to oneself, true to one's experience. What is going on? We can't really make any progress. We can't really bring about any integration if we don't know ourselves, if we don't know what we're feeling, if we don't know what our emotions are. We're not going to really make very much progress, you know, if we're sort of deluding ourselves and cheating ourselves. We need to name and label what our emotions are, experience them and label them. There's another aspect of mindfulness. It's mentioned in the Seven Bodhiangas. It comes after sati in that sense. It's known as Dhamma Pravicaya, which means the investigation of mental states. And it's really a sort of labelling, a naming of what the content of your emotional life is. But with a very particular purpose, you're able to see and weigh and to assess what is skillful, what is unskillful. Or to put it another way, what is profitable and what is unprofitable? What's going to lead to growth? What's actually going to lead to, well, disintegration? What's going to lead to integration and greater mindfulness, greater alertness, and what's going to drain that? You start to notice that. So there's also this sort of sense of seeing the effect of entertaining particular emotions. This is another aspect of mindfulness, seeing the effects of particular emotions. You know, sometimes people come to me and they say, well, I'm feeling really miserable. So they tell me what they've been dwelling on. I said, well, not surprising, is it really? You are going to be really miserable. You know, if you've been entertaining resentment and ill will and fear and anxiety, and you've spent the whole day doing that, don't expect to feel blissed out. Don't expect to feel that there's great progress. That's not going to happen. You know, that's not part of the deal. You know, if you've been entertaining those emotions, you know, you are going to be miserable. But if, you know, the other side is true, and if people say, you know, I'm feeling really happy, really good, and you say, why? And they say, well, actually, I've been experiencing a lot of metta today, a lot of friendliness, and I've been really generous, and so on. Well, yeah, you know, so do the sums, do the math, as the Americans say. You know, there's a connection between the emotions that we're experiencing and the actual feeling tone that we're experiencing. So we need a much more fine-grained awareness of our emotional life. This is really important, because another translation of the word sati and smriti, another meaning of it, is conscience. This is not always brought out. Sometimes mindfulness is presented as a sort of neutral kind of mental state. You're just a sort of neutral observer, and you're getting into that neutral space with the camberwell carrot. reference to an English film called With Nail and I. Sorry about that. But that is not mindfulness. Mindfulness also has a quality of conscience. You have a sort of sense, you can, a knowing, a direct knowing, even a kind of ethico-aesthetic sense. This is profitable. This leads to victory. This leads to downfall. This leads to growth and development. This leads to disintegration. This leads to spiritual progress. So there is a knowing, an intelligence, even a sort of wisdom in mindfulness. So you know, an attuned up quality. You start learning what is conducive to integration and development and transformation, and what isn't. So that's another very important aspect of it. I think the other thing I just want to say about mindfulness of emotions, another vision, if you like, of Sangha Rakshitas, is that there is a kind of view in the West that by and large, it's that post-Freudian thing, isn't it? That really we're made up of pretty mean, selfish, nasty, kind of dirty, self-interested emotions. You know, that basically the real us is negative. Sangha Rakshita, you know, what's repressed is basically negative. Sangha Rakshita says no. He doesn't agree with that. He said, how do you know that actually it isn't the really positive that is dying to come out, is dying to be expressed, that we've continually sat on? And I'd just like to make a plea for that. Look for the positive in your experience. Look for the positive emotions and have the confidence of your positive emotions. The confidence to love. The confidence to love, especially in the sense of friendliness and metta. The confidence to be generous. And you can let rip with that if they arise in meditation. Satyaraja was talking about that. You know, looking for those positive qualities in experience. They are there. Remember years ago, it was a meditation retreat here. My meditation interviewer was Kamala Sheela. And he was quite tough with me because I was saying that my meditation was rubbish. It was just, you know, just 40 minutes or 50 minutes of just unalloyed rubbish. And it wasn't worth talking about. Well, he wasn't having that. So he said, well, explain to me what happened. So I talked about my meditation. He said, but that's positive and that's positive. And that's positive. That's a growing point. Why don't you dwell on that? And it's embarrassing to say so. I'd never sort of thought of that. I'd sort of written off my meditation because these growing points were sort of short-lived and rather weak. And he's saying, no, don't do that. Give them attention. Give them a lot of attention. And they'll grow if you give them attention. So have the courage of positive emotions. If you become aware of them, don't just sort of, oh, well, that's jolly interesting, you know, and then kind of go back to your kind of bland, boring state. Give it attention. Let it grow. Let it expand. And then the third area is mindfulness of thoughts, awareness of thoughts flowing through the mind. You know, quite a few people said at the beginning of the retreat about the mental chatter. You know, there they are sitting there, and there's the constant sort of chatter about this. I don't know about about you, but my mind is just such a chatterbox, from the sublime to the sordid, you know, in terms of thoughts. I mean, really ridiculous. I mean, goodness knows what's going to happen after death in the Bardo. I mean, there's going to be everything from, you know, wonderful sort of passages of Sufi poetry right through to advertising jingles from the 1970s. Everything in between. It's frightening. It's frightening. You know, what a sponge, you know, and, you know, what a glutton for rubbish. There you go. Never mind. I'm doomed, but it's okay. Doesn't matter in the end. Awareness, mindfulness. You know, one of the things I noticed on a meditation retreat is that I'm much more aware of the chatter, quite simply because I've closed down a lot of other things. So the chatter is louder. It's there all the time, but I can just hear it more. But what happens, you know, through the practice of mindfulness, and I think we're especially fortunate to be doing a lot of just sitting, we've got a chance to, in a way, give that a really big space for it to really quieten down. That's what he says, you know, really starts to happen through mindfulness of thoughts. You don't have to go into the thoughts. You just let the chatter be there and it starts to quieten. Starts to sort of disappear. And he says, you don't go into a blank state. What is happening, of course, is that the energy that's going into all these, this ratiocination, this discursive thinking, and the energy that's going into negative emotion, it is all flowing into the meditation object and then flowing into higher states of consciousness. And I think it's the second dhyana. There is no mental activity at all. There's no thought. But there is this wonderful, you know, percolation of this flow of bliss and inspiration and absorption. And it's said that the Buddha says that the Aryan silence that he often used to sit in with his monks, the Aryan silence, begins with the second dhyana. You know, we have the normal silence, and that's growing on this retreat. But then as we get more and more into it, we'll start moving towards the Aryan silence, the beginning of the real noble silence, as the mental chatter dies away. Mindfulness of thoughts also starts to lead to directed thinking. There can be this view that no thought is that has any place in Buddhist practice. Well, that's not true, because there is such a thing as the chintamaya prajna, the wisdom that comes through reflection and intently thinking on something. So this is another way of using thought. So in your highly mindful, concentrated mind, you know, you can start to introduce reflections on the Dharma. Perhaps this would be something that comes in a bit later on in the retreat, a particular truth of the Buddha's. Very, very simple idea, if you like, which you drop into consciousness. Of course, it's more than an idea. It starts to explode into consciousness, or starts to ripple through consciousness, and can even start setting up a direct kind of insight into the nature of things. So mindfulness of thoughts also leads to this directed, this concentrated thinking. So that's mindfulness of the self, body and its movements, feelings and emotions and thoughts. Then the third dimension of awareness is mindfulness of other people. I think this is another reason why this dimension of awareness is, these four dimensions of awareness are so good, because it's got people in it. So sometimes when people are very mindful, they forget about others around them. But mindfulness is also metta. Mindfulness is also metta. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha talks about continual mindfulness of the practice of metta. So he's describing metta as a mindfulness, and mindfulness as a metta practice. And in another place, Sangharakshita says that love is awareness of the being of another. Awareness of the being of another. Mindfulness of their being, of their living beingness. That's what metta is. It's mindfulness. It's nothing separate from mindfulness. So mindfulness must include other people. We're very, very aware of our own living beingness. And as we develop in our practice, as we develop that vigilance, that apramada, that will become stronger. But we need to become aware of the living beingness of others, even to the extent that we're aware of our own. The great Shantideva talks about this very, very strongly in his Perfection of Meditation chapter in the Bodhicharavatara. He talks about the Bodhisattva's meditation, and he talks about it in terms of developing an imaginative identification with all others. We're very aware that we want to avoid suffering and we wish to be happy. We're very aware of wanting to protect ourselves, of wanting to live well, of wanting not to die. We're very, very aware of that. Everybody else is exactly the same. They are no different from us. To love somebody, we don't need to have lots of information about them. We just need to recognise that they are the same as us in that essential sense. They are. We need to recognise their living beingness, and not just human beings, but all life. And it's from that that loving kindness, you know, really develops. Sometimes people struggle in the metta bhavana, and they struggle because they haven't done this imaginative identification with others. They're not, as it were, seeing themselves in others. You need to do that in the stages of the practice. Others are the same as you, essentially. Shantideva goes even further, where he even advocates actually sort of feeling as though you are another. As though you are another, and you sort of look back at yourself, wishing this other well. I mean, I'm not recommending that you do that, but it, you know, you can see the sort of point he's making, and you know that to love, you need to have this quality of really being tuned in to others, as if you can feel as they're feeling. Keats talks about this in terms of negative capability. It's a strange phrase. Negative means is that you sort of suspend yourself, and you have the capability of identifying with all life around you. And he also talks about this as disinterestedness, in the sense of you're not excessively interested in yourself, so that you can enter into the life of another. He used to say he could feel what it was like for the sparrow outside his window pecking away in the gravel. He could feel what it was to be that sparrow. That's what he claimed. That's what he said. Well, we need to do that. And we need to do that with everybody. We don't put any kind of limit on it. You know, on this retreat, you've probably already decided the people that you don't like the look of, and that, you know, you're going to sort of try and dodge through the retreat or something like that. I hope I'm not projecting myself. But they are the best people to do imaginative identification with. They're the very, very best people, because we're learning to extend the range of our mindfulness, our loving mindfulness, to really go to the other, you know, to connect with the other, not just staying with the known and the familiar. So that's mindfulness, the field of mindfulness, the field of awareness of other. Then the fourth dimension of mindfulness and awareness is mindfulness of reality. Awareness of reality. Awareness of the way things are. I should just say as well that these dimensions of awareness, you know, not discrete. This is one of the reasons why I think they're so good. You know, you practice them all the time. You know, you'll probably be concentrating some more than others depending on your circumstances. Mindfulness of reality is all pervasive. It's all pervasive. And there's all sorts of different ways that one can do this. It could be mindfulness of the lakshanas, for example, mindfulness of impermanence, of the impermanent nature of everything. You know, that you're mindful in all these areas, things, self, other people, of change, of this constant arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And I note the arising and passing away. It's not just passing away. It's mutual arising and ceasing, ceasing and arising. You know, you don't. It's an extreme to think of it just in terms of ceasing, or just in terms of arising. You know, there's always arising and ceasing in experience. It would be, if you just dwell on ceasing, you'll end up being depressed and nihilistic. If you just dwell on arising, you're going to end up becoming, you know, sort of hopeless, over hopeful and eternalistic. It's much more mysterious and complex and much more interesting than that. You know, look at your breath, for example. Look at it sort of coming and going. It's arising and ceasing. If you really use those ideas with the breath, you get very, very interested in the breath, and you actually start to find, actually, the words arising and ceasing don't really apply to what's happening. And you start to notice the sort of mystery of experience, that it defies any kind of labelling, if you like. So that's an area, awareness of impermanence. But Sangha actually particularly mentions mindfulness of the Buddha. I think this is really important, mindfulness of the Buddha. Mindfulness of enlightenment. Mindfulness of reality by being mindful of the enlightened person. If you like, the real person. The person of reality. I think this is important because we tend to go very abstract, probably because of our education in the West, but people, generalising, people get very abstracted. Well, there's no such thing as enlightenment. There's only enlightened people. There wasn't enlightenment sort of floating around the cosmos. And then the Buddha says, oh, look, there's enlightenment. It's not like that. No, a human being attained enlightenment and lived enlightenment and lived enlightenment in relation to other people. So we need to embody enlightenment. We need to get a feeling of the qualities of enlightenment. And there's this wonderful practice from Buddhist tradition called Buddhanusmriti or Buddhanusati, the mindfulness of the Buddha, the recollection of the Buddha. And it came out of the experience of disciples. You know, it literally means recollecting the Buddha because the Buddha was their teacher. So naturally they would remember him. There's a wonderful story about Ananda after the enlightenment going back to the Gandakuti in the Jetta Grove in Anantapindika's park near Shravasti. And he goes to this place where the Buddha always used to stay. He stayed for 20 rainy seasons in retreat. The Gandakuti, the perfume chamber. And Ananda went in and behaved as if the Buddha was there. He cleaned out all the faded flower garlands. He swept the floor. He laid out a seat. He got a water bowl and filled it up. And he sat as if the Buddha was present, praising this room where the Buddha sat. He sat in the presence of his teacher. And there's a comment by a later commentator says, because he was excessively attached to the Buddha, slightly pejoratively. But I think that's unfair. I don't think that's really the point. Of course, Ananda will meditate on enlightenment as the enlightened person. He will meditate on enlightenment by recollecting his teacher. Because that will bring the qualities of enlightenment so vividly into presence. He would recollect the Buddha's love, the Buddha's compassion, the Buddha's kindness, which he had a direct experience of, the Buddha's mindfulness, his radiant mindfulness and presence. He'd recollect all those things, his energy, his poise, his stillness, his silence, and that quality that you just cannot pin down. This is a natural human thing to do, to remember those you revere, those you really look up to and revere, who really embody qualities for you. You will naturally do that as a human being. I was on a solitary retreat recently and having a lot of images of Sangharakshita coming up because, you know, he's my beloved teacher, but particularly remembering what it was like to meditate with him and to really remembering this deep, deep stillness that he would occupy, this rooted quality, this deep silence and mystery around him. And as I recollected, you know, that memory, I got more and more deeply into my meditation. So remembering, you know, we remember when we remember the Buddha, the very embodiment of mindfulness, the very embodiment of awareness, natural mindfulness. And in this way, we can tune into reality itself, the way things are. If we could really imagine the Buddha, well, we might even end up seeing things as they really are. Seeing things with wisdom, seeing things with compassion. Maybe even getting a little glimpse of that spontaneous, compassionate activity that I talked about at the beginning. So that's a little bit on mindfulness of reality. I'm going to say a bit more about that in the talk the day after tomorrow. I'm going to finish the talk, though, with some poetry by Sangharakshita, which I think brings together the dimensions of awareness in a very, very human way. They're from some poems he wrote back in the 60s, the very early days of the movement. and they're from a section called Chinese poems. They're in a sort of Chinese style, and there are six very short poems written in retreat. So that's very appropriate. He'd gone on retreat with a friend, with an order member, very early days of the movement. I think it's just after the first ordinations, actually. Yes, it was just after the first ordinations into the Western Buddhist order, the founding of the order, this momentous step in founding the order. So six poems written in retreat, and then there's another one remembering the retreat. So I'll just read this just to, well, we're on retreat with Sangharakshita. See what that's like. Beyond the deserted paddock, a dark wood. Before our secluded hut, wet strips of green and brown. Watching the incense burn in this quiet room, we have forgotten the passing of days and hours. The candle has long since guttered and died, and in the darkness there is no sound but the slow click of wooden beads. The winter moon has long since risen and set, and dawn waits for the sleepy crow of the first croc. A tangle of knotted branches on either side, the lichen steps deep in red leaves, wind to the brow of the hill. The morning air is tinged with sadness when we reflect how short a path leads back into the dust of the world. A solitary figure, you pick your way among orange bracken and silver birches. What thoughts are yours, I wonder, gazing up at the old pine tree? Paths left behind, I lose myself in the violet shadows of deep woods. Idly gazing up at the old pine tree, no thought mars the tranquillity of my mind. Amongst dense trees, dimly lit, moisture drips from dank branches. Deep in wet leaves, the muddy lane vanishes downhill into the white mist. Remembering the retreat. At the wood's edge, a solitary hut. Sharing my quiet room, a single friend. Here on the table, two or three books of verse. There on the shelf, half a dozen frost-blackened violets. Hour after hour, we exchange only a few words. Day after day, I polish a single poem. Who would have thought it? A whole world of content found in these things.